Good day.
Today is Thursday, 12th March 2026. And before I proceed with this program, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this program or whichever part of this program you want to watch, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, let me begin by saying that I'm going to discuss again today mostly the conflict in and around Iran and the conflict in Ukraine. But at the outset, in my discussion of the conflict in and around Iran, I'm going to say that in reality and in fact, the underlying situation, the basic calculus, has not changed. The United States, Israel, continue to strike targets in Iran. They continue to inflict great devastation upon that country. Iran continues, for its part, to conduct drone and missile strikes against American or Israeli targets. The Gulf states remain in a state of extreme crisis, and the Straits of Hormuz remains closed. These are the salient and important facts. There is a huge amount of rhetoric. There is an awful lot of propaganda and misdirection. There is a great deal of fake news. And I say fake news, I mean intentionally fake news. Things that are being said by both sides, which sometimes appear plausible, sometimes we all believe, but which on careful examination turn out to be different from what we imagined. But the underlying facts, the simple basic facts, are the ones that I have set out. The US and Israel continue their strikes against Iran. Iran continues its strikes against Israel and the United States, and the Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz, remains closed. Now, there have been various claims about the situation in the Straits of Hormuz. Yesterday, I discussed reports that the Iranians are mining the Straits of Hormuz. The Iranians have not either admitted or denied this. The reports that the Iranians were mining the Straits of Hormuz came from the United States. There were lots of people who came out and said that this was not true. There are reports in the Wall Street Journal and in Reuters that oil tankers, Iranian-controlled oil tankers, are passing through the Straits of Hormuz carrying oil to China, that Iran's oil exports to China have so far been unaffected. These reports, as I said, have appeared in extremely solid, or at least until recently solid, journals like the Wall Street Journal and Reuters. I've no doubt that in the case of the Wall Street Journal, at least, they've been provided this information by third parties that they consider reliable. But I get to say straight away, I've heard that this information is wrong, and I myself have doubts about this. I am not at all clear how Iran, in the midst of an attack of this kind, is in any position to export oil. Even if it could export oil, even if it allowed ships from Iran ferrying oil to China to pass the Straits of Hormuz, I find it very difficult to understand how the US Navy, which controls the Indian Ocean, would allow that to happen. Just saying. So, I mean, there's some of those reports circulating, and this has led to skepticism that the Iranians have indeed mined the Straits of Hormuz. However, I've also seen video footage which appears to originate from Iran, which does appear to show new sophisticated Iranian mines operating, or at least located, in the Straits of Hormuz area. Maybe that video footage is fake. Possibly it is. But personally, I would be surprised about that. I think it makes complete sense for the Iranians to mine the Straits of Hormuz if ships are indeed passing through the Straits of Hormuz, taking oil to China, contrary to all my expectations, then I would guess that the Iranians have means of doing that. They, after all, are the people who are laying the mines, and they presumably have safe channels through which they can guide these ships and through which these ships can pass. Again, let me reiterate, I don't know exactly what is taking place, but one way or the other, the Straits of Hormuz continue to be closed for most shipping. And we have just, as it happens, had a statement from the new supreme leader of Iran. I am going to call him Khamenei the Second. I noticed that the Iranian media have started to refer to him as Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Ayatollah Sayyid Mojtaba Khamenei. The other one was his father. So previously, he was not, until he was elected, Iran's supreme leader. He apparently was not an Ayatollah, but it looks as if the Iranian Assembly of Experts, when they elected him Iran's new supreme leader, decided that they would upgrade his clerical rank to Ayatollah as well. Anyway, I'm not going to waste time about that. This is something that is less important. What is important are these words in an address he has made to the Iranian people today, his first address to the Iranian people, one made in writing, not in the form of a television address. But anyway, this is what the new Ayatollah Khamenei has said to the Iranian people today. The will of the people is to continue effective defence, and their presence on the scene must be maintained. The Strait of Hormuz must remain closed. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Many have said that the Iranians never did, in fact, close the Straits of Hormuz at all, that the instructions to the ship owners to stop sending tankers through the Straits of Hormuz supposedly came from the insurance companies based in London. Others say, as I've just discussed, that the Iranians have not mined the Straits of Hormuz. But the man who is now the supreme leader of Iran, he has said that the Strait of Hormuz must remain closed. Apparently, there's been, according to Bloomberg, requests to Iran from the Indian government for Iran to reopen the Straits of Hormuz so that tankers carrying oil from the Persian Gulf can reach India. I don't know why the Indians believe that Iran would agree to a request of that kind. Just saying. At the moment, the mood in Iran seems to be very critical of India indeed, especially following Prime Minister Modi's trip to Israel 3 days before the conflict began, and even more following the sinking of the Iranian frigate in the Indian Ocean by the US Navy after that frigate had visited India to participate in a naval exercise with no statement of condemnation or rebuke from Prime Minister Modi himself or from the Indian government in connection with that American sinking of that frigate. So I don't know why the Indian government would think that the Iranians would relent on this, why they would agree to reopen the Straits of Hormuz so that India could receive oil. But anyway, it looks as if the Iranians are not going to do that. And we now have this categorical, positive, unequivocal statement from the man who now leads Iran that the Straits of Hormuz must remain closed. And, well, that, it seems to me, is completely unsurprising, because put aside the very real damage that Iran's drones and missiles are causing across the Middle East, and I suspect in Israel too, Iran's main weapon, if you like, in this conflict is the closure of the Straits of Hormuz and the havoc this is causing in the global economy, the energy shock that this is producing. And I cannot see any reason, any logic at this time for Iran that would compel Iran or persuade Iran to reopen the Straits of Hormuz, depriving itself, in effect, of that weapon. Now, yesterday, we had the biggest, apparently, release, or at least an agreement by the G7 states to undertake the biggest ever release of oil from the international reserves. And the response of the markets to this news was very interesting, because the price of oil actually rose. Immediately before I started making this program today, I checked what is the price of Brent crude, which seems to be the international benchmark, and it is just short of $100 a barrel. It is in fact $99 a barrel. Other grades of oil are higher. One is at $120 a barrel, though I understand that is not a widely traded grade of oil. Others are lower, in the upper 80s or lower 90s. But anyway, there was an upward spike in the oil price yesterday, and that appears to continue this morning. And, well, there's been an article about the situation in oilprice.com, the international journal, if you like, of the international oil industry. And it says IEA warns of largest oil supply disruption in history. And the article continues, the Middle East war is creating the biggest supply disruption in the history of the oil market, as flows of about 20 billion barrels per day of crude and products through the Strait of Hormuz have crashed to a trickle, the International Energy Agency said on Thursday. With limited capacity available to bypass the crucial waterway and storage filling up, Gulf countries have slashed their combined oil production by at least 10 million barrels per day, the IEA said. In the absence of a rapid resumption of shipping flows, supply losses are set to increase. And this is also from the agency. And Oilprice.com reminds us that on Wednesday, the IAEA announced the biggest ever coordinated emergency release of stocks of 400 million barrels from reserves. And we continue to read that just a short time ago, there was talk about a surplus of oil, but that there is no surplus of oil today. And we're told that in the wake of the Middle East war, global oil supply is set to plunge by 8 million barrels per day in March, with curtailments in the Middle East partly offset by higher output from non-OPEC plus producers, principally Kazakhstan and Russia. The emergency stock release wouldn't be able to offset a prolonged supply loss. The coordinated emergency stock release provides a significant and welcome buffer, but in the absence of a swift resolution to the conflict, it remains a stopgap measure, the IEA said today. The ultimate impact on oil and gas markets and the broader economy from the conflict will depend not only on the intensity of military attacks and any damage to energy assets, but also critically on the duration of disruptions to shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. So, given that this is so, why would Iran, currently under attack and fighting back, why would Iran agree to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, taking the pressure off those who are currently attacking it? Now, this is an extraordinary situation. I was reading, I think it was in the New York Times yesterday, that apparently the Trump administration, when they were planning this attack on Iran, discounted the possibility of Iran closing the Strait of Hormuz. Apparently, it was a possibility they considered but rejected. I find that, by the way, completely astonishing. Just saying. The Israelis, there's been an interesting report in The Guardian this morning, the British newspaper The Guardian, which says that we attacked Iran, this is the title, with no clear plan for regime change, Israeli security sources say. And then we're told that if the regime holds, control of enriched uranium may be the ultimate measure of US-Israeli success. And then the article goes on to say that there is no sign so far of any weakening of the Iranian government's control over the country, and that the Iranian government, the Iranian authorities, seem to be confidently in charge of the internal situation within Iran. And in light of this, and with increasing doubts within Israel itself that the original objective of the war, regime change in Iran, is achievable, the discussion now is to find some face-saving way to end the war. And I should make it clear that when I speak of a face-saving way to end the war, that is my take on this. To repeat again a point I made in program after program, the true objective was regime change all along. But if you're not going to achieve that, and you want to say that you've succeeded, even if in the ultimate objective you have failed, anyway, the alternative, the off-ramp, if you like, the face-saving off-ramp, is to find some way of either capturing and removing or depleting Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium. the same stockpile of enriched uranium, which Donald Trump, of course, confidently said after the attack in June last year had been either obliterated or placed beyond use. And the Guardian tells us that the United States is reportedly considering sending troops on a high-risk mission to secure the uranium. And we're then told by a former official, I'm not sure whether he's an American or an Israeli official, it's a high-risk game, this war, because if it succeeds, it would completely change the Middle East for the best, from an American and Israeli point of view, of course. But if we bomb everything and the regime stays in power and they continue to maintain those 400 kilos of uranium, I think we will be starting the countdown to an attempt by Iran to go to a nuclear weapon. The worst result, and this is from Joab Rosenberg, former deputy head of Israel's military intelligence research division, the worst result of this war will be the declaration of victory of the type of June 2025, leaving the Iranian regime weak with 450 kilos of enriched uranium in its hands. So they will 100% be going for a nuclear bomb, and our victory will become our loss. Well, again, all of this was completely predictable. On the Duran, after the June 2025 war, we pointed out that the attack on Iran's nuclear facilities that took place during the course of that war and the removal of the inspectors from the IAEA that shortly afterwards followed meant that the case in Iran for Iran to proceed towards a nuclear weapons capability had become much more compelling. And it seemed to us at the Duran that the capability to do that was probably still there. And incidentally, Arnaud Bertrand, that outstanding commentator, mostly about China-connected matters, as he has recently reminded us, also in June 2025, published a long piece pointing out why the Iranians might be saying to themselves, following the 12-day war, that the course followed by the government of North Korea to develop total self-sufficiency and to move towards nuclear weapons possession was the only way to guarantee security. Well, as it happens, the Iranians don't seem to have taken any serious steps towards developing a nuclear bomb after the June 2025 war. And the probable reason for that is that there was still that categorical prohibition on doing that from the previous supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, the same Khamenei who the United States and Israel killed on the first day of the current war. We have, as this article in The Guardian sort of admits, or at least it has Israeli officials sort of admit, that the new Khamenei, who is now the supreme leader of Iran, he might be much less inhibited. He's said to be a hardliner. Many members of his family, including his father and his wife and some of his siblings apparently, and possibly one of his children, were killed in the initial strike. There are reports which seem to be true that he was wounded in that strike himself, that his foot was broken and that he suffered lacerations, which may explain, by the way, why he's not appearing on television, and that anyway, he was injured in some ways. Anyway, it may be that makes him even less inhibited, more angry with Israel and the United States, more willing than perhaps he already might have been to move forward towards acquiring an Iranian nuclear weapons capability. To repeat a point I've made many times, this is, for me, a terrible prospect. I am a strong believer in nuclear non-proliferation. I think the spread of nuclear weapons and their acquisition by more and more countries is incredibly dangerous and brings us much closer to the point where nuclear weapons will be used, which I consider to be a disaster. But back in June 2025, I said that the attack on Iran then looked like it was going to bring us closer to that point. And now we see that Israeli intelligence and security officials, after the failure to achieve regime change in Iran, are now worrying about that too. And instead, we have this harebrained plan, because to me it looks harebrained, to somehow go into Iran and to try to remove this stockpile. That, of course, critically assumes that the United States and Israel know where that stockpile is. There are many rumours that it is located inside a tunnel close to the city of Isfahan. Possibly. I've heard, by the way, that a lot of this enriched uranium is in a gaseous or liquid form, so it would be all but impossible to remove. What would need to be done instead would be either to seal the entrance of the tunnel or to destroy it in some way, which I'm not going to discuss because I don't understand fully these things. But why assume, anyway, that the Iranians have kept all of their enriched uranium, their highly enriched uranium, in one place? Why assume that it might not be in all sorts of different places? Perhaps US and Israeli intelligence have been able to penetrate Iranian security to the level that they know where this enriched uranium is. I've spoken in the past that it was clear to me that Israel and the United States have indeed successfully achieved a very high level of penetration of Iran's security agencies. But set against that the fact that the Americans and the Israelis appear to have initiated this war in the belief that following the assassination of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei I, that regime change would quickly follow, and that hasn't happened. So perhaps they were wrong about that. Perhaps they don't know so much about that in Iran, about what's actually going on in Iran after all. And then, of course, all of these ideas, all of this talk about this high-risk operation to gain control of the enriched uranium is all over there in the media. It's in the British media, it's in the American media, it's apparently been discussed extensively in the Israeli media. The Iranians presumably are aware of all of this. If we're talking about Isfahan, that is far inside their own country. How would forces be inserted deep inside Iran to carry out an operation of that kind? Wouldn't the Iranians themselves be taking steps to safeguard against it? Well, the Guardian article talks about it being high risk. I would have thought that it was at the extreme end of that. Now, I would add that I saw earlier today a report, or an alleged report, by an Iranian official. And it seems to come from the Iranian media. But again, I'm not sure whether this report is real. As I said, there are lots of fakes out there. Or whether, of course, this Iranian official is saying, military official, I should stress, is saying things that are strictly true. But this Iranian official said that the Iranians have a complete understanding of where all the American bases are, of where how many US troops are located in these bases, about where American naval, American warships are located, be it in the Eastern Mediterranean or in the Arabian Sea, that they have, in other words, a complete intelligence picture of American and Israeli military deployments. Now, of course, this may be completely untrue. It may simply be a case of boasting. Iran, however, has shown over the course of the last 2 weeks that it did in advance have a fairly clear picture of where many American installations, radars and missile batteries and that sort of thing were located. Maybe the Iranians do have this information, which then brings us back to the question of where they've obtained, how did they obtain it? Did they obtain it from local informants? That seems to me unlikely. That would be human intelligence operation on an enormous scale, which I think is beyond Iran's capabilities. Iran does have some satellites, but I understand that they're relatively few, and I don't believe it has that level of satellite coverage. If Iran does indeed have this depth of information about American military positions and deployments across the Middle East and in the Mediterranean and in the Arabian Sea, then that brings us back to the point that I have been making and discussing in many programs now. They must be getting this information from their two key friends, China and Russia, who absolutely do have the satellites and the other means of reconnaissance to obtain information of that kind. Indeed, I saw another report yesterday, and perhaps this is another one of those reports that you need to have a question mark against, but again, I believe it to be true, that China has deployed another advanced spy ship to the area, which is keeping careful track of the movement of the American warships in the Arabian Sea, and which is therefore in a position to keep the Iranians informed about what it is doing. So, given that this is true, if this is true, if what this Iranian official says is true, and if the Iranians are obtaining all of this information, and there have now been multiple reports and good reasons to think that they are, is it likely that an operation, a military operation, to insert forces into Iran, deep inside Iran, to secure the uranium there, is it really likely that it could happen without the Iranians being alerted to it in advance? And since this is their own country, and since they have sizable armed forces, well, one can easily see, if so, how this could all go very quickly, catastrophically wrong. And that brings us to the other thing that we have seen over the last 2 weeks, which is the inability of the US Navy to break the blockade of the Straits of Hormuz. I spoke yesterday about how there has been a cascade of requests to the US military, to the US Navy, coming, it seems, from multiple sources to provide escorts for tankers to pass the Straits of Hormuz, for the US Navy to pass the Straits of Hormuz, to break the blockade of the Straits of Hormuz, and how the US Navy has rejected all of those requests, saying that for the moment, this is too complex and difficult, and of course, ultimately dangerous an operation for the US Navy to undertake. And, well, I've discussed why. I've discussed how if US Navy warships reach the Strait of Hormuz, they're well within range of Iranian missile and drones. How, in fact, by the way, I believe they might be just within range of Iranian conventional artillery. There's, of course, also the uncertainty about the mines, whether the Straits of Hormuz has been mined, with the enormous further complication to which that would give rise. And again, I have to say that if the US Navy is avoiding the Straits of Hormuz, that seems to me wisdom. And I hope that they stick to that. By the way, and on an aside, here I am going to make certain observations about the conflict in Ukraine that arise from the events that we have seen over the course of the last 2 weeks, from the conflict between the United States and Israel and Iran. Firstly, there's been this narrative which we have endlessly heard about how Ukraine supposedly won this great victory in the Black Sea, how it pushed the Russian Navy out of the Black Sea, how this has been a profound humiliation for the Russians. I've pushed back hard against this. I pointed out that the Russians, if they had wanted to, could close the port of Odessa at any time using mines, submarines and missiles. And by the way, I believe that that is exactly what they have done. And that it seemed to me anyway, folly for the Russians to deploy their navy, to put their navy in harm's way when there was no need to. Well, let's look at the situation in the war in Iran. The Iranians have blockaded the Straits of Hormuz using missiles, drones and mines, exactly what the Russians can do and to some extent are doing with Odessa at the moment. They don't need naval ships to do it. And the Americans are keeping their navy out of harm's way, which is exactly what the Russians have been doing in the Black Sea and have been ridiculed for just making these points. It's strange that no one else makes them. Incidentally, and since I'm on this track, I recall many, many claims made by people, for example, like General Kellogg, that if the United States were to enter the war in Ukraine, it would rapidly achieve aerial dominance. It would drive the Russian Air Force from the skies, that it would inflict colossal damage upon the Russian military, that the Russians would be in no position to do any significant damage against it, or if they did do some damage, it would be damage that was containable, and that it was well within the power of the United States and of NATO to establish a no-fly zone over Ukraine. Well, I have to say that looking at what the United States and Israel, using a huge proportion of their air power, have managed up to now in the conflict in Ukraine, all of those claims about the US and NATO's abilities, over Iran, all of those claims about what the US and NATO would be able to achieve over Ukraine seem utterly fantastical. The Russian air defense system is far more sophisticated and immeasurably more powerful than Iran's. The Russian Air Force operates at a completely different level of scale and technology than Iran's. The distances between NATO bases and the front lines in Ukraine are even greater, as I understand it, than the distances that apply in Iran, in the conflict in Iran. US and NATO bases in Eastern Europe would be as vulnerable to drone and missile attacks from Russia as US bases in the Middle East have been to attacks by Iran. Iran has no system comparable to the Oreshnik. I think we can put all of these fairy tales about an American aerial dominance over the skies of Ukraine entirely to one side, following the realities that we have seen in the conflict between the United States, Israel, and Iran. Now, all of that takes us back to this question that I've been asking for some time. The Iranians have achieved this situation. They've closed the Straits of Hormuz. They've attacked the American bases across the Middle East. They've created this enormous disruption in global energy markets. They've managed, up to now at least, to ensure survival for their government and political system. Regime change in Iran has not happened. All of the top security and political figures, Khamenei II, Larijani, Pezeshkian, are still in place. What, however, are Iran's objectives? Well, there have been some reports that the Iranians have now been setting out at least some of their views. And interestingly, it also struck me, if we go back to Ukraine, that there are some resemblances between the Iranian approach and the Russian. The Russians, ever since the start of the special military operation, have repeatedly said and continue to say that they will not accept a ceasefire. A temporary ceasefire would be pointless. All it would do would be to provide Ukraine and the Western powers with a further opportunity to re-equip and to rearm in order to resume the war at some later date. And this is a position that the Russians have held to consistently ever since the start of the special military operation, rejecting demands for a ceasefire, which came, by the way, in February and March 2022 from Scholz and Macron, rejecting again demands for a ceasefire when they came from some of their BRICS partners, notably Brazil, but to a certain extent also India and China in 2024, and rejecting demands from a ceasefire when they came from the United States, from President Trump and his peace envoy, General Kellogg, in the first half of last year. The Iranians are saying exactly the same. Larijani issued a statement yesterday in which he said that Iran has been approached by all sorts of mediators who have been floating the possibility of some kind of ceasefire. He didn't identify the mediators. They might be coming from various Arab states, and of course they might also be the Russians. But Larijani said, and Khamenei II appears to agree with him, that Iran is not interested in a ceasefire, that a ceasefire would only be a pause in the conflict, that it would allow the other side, Israel and the United States, to re-equip and replenish and to prepare for a further attack. Iran was wrong to agree to a ceasefire in June of last year. The only way this conflict ends if there is a permanent resolution, which must be ultimately on Iranian terms. So there is actually a very interesting commonality in positions, diplomatic positions, between the Iranians and the Russians, though there are obviously important differences as well. The Russians, however, have set out their demands, which they did at the very start of the special military operation, and which they then expanded in June 2024, when Putin made a speech to the foreign ministry in which he laid out the set of conditions which I call Istanbul Plus. But up to now, the Iranians have not formally done the same. But yesterday, I began to see the first reports which do appear to originate from Iranian government sources and which do seem to point to the kind of outcome that Iran is working towards. Firstly, they are repeating apparently their demand that all American bases in the Persian Gulf, and presumably in Iraq, by the way, that all of those bases should be closed. I believe the United States has already made a decision to close the Iraqi bases, so that isn't a significant concession. But obviously, the United States closing its bases in Bahrain, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, that would be a massive thing. Secondly, the Iranians are now saying that they are no longer interested in negotiating limits on their rights to enrich uranium. They want unrestricted freedom to enrich uranium, to develop the full cycle of uranium enrichment as they choose. Now, I have to say that for the United States and Israel to accept that, going back to that article in The Guardian, well, that would be a recognition of defeat on such a scale that I cannot imagine that either President Trump or Prime Minister Netanyahu would be able to survive it politically. But apparently, that is a demand that the Iranians are making. They are making some sort of demands for some kind of security architecture in the Persian Gulf, and they say that they're prepared to discuss this with the Arab states, with the Gulf states, and they do demand compensation for the damage that the Israelis and the Americans have inflicted upon them. Now, these are extraordinary demands. They are far tougher than the demands the Russians have made of the West up to now. They go far beyond in scope Istanbul Plus, just to say. And, well, as I said already, for the Americans and the Israelis to agree to demands of this kind, I think is politically impossible. But it's important to say that with the Straits of Hormuz closed, with the energy supply crisis that the IEA is talking about, which I discuss in that article in oilpriced.com, the pressure on the United States and on Israel to find some means to bring this conflict to an end is going to go on increasing with every further day that the conflict continues. Now, there are reports that Prime Minister Netanyahu, whose entire political future is now riding on the outcome of this war, a war that he has been calling for pretty much as long as I can remember. Anyway, there are reports that Prime Minister Netanyahu has become increasingly nervous that Donald Trump, that the United States might wobble. He apparently was concerned that the United States has made some sort of approaches to Iran through mediators in order to find some kind of off-ramp to the war. He apparently contacted the United States yesterday to see whether such contacts between the United States and the Iranians through intermediaries were indeed taking place, and he was reassured that the United States was not talking to the Iranians at all. Well, that, by the way, is certainly not true. Trump, as we know, called Putin the other day. I discussed that call at extensive length in a program, and we also talked about it at great length in the Duran. All the indications are, by the way, that that meeting did not go at all well. But when Trump called Putin, he would certainly have known that Putin would pass on whatever Trump said to Putin to the Iranians. And that is exactly what Putin did. There is no secret or mystery about it. The day after the call from Putin, Putin picked up the telephone and called Pezeshkian, the president of Iran, and undoubtedly briefed Pezeshkian about the call from Trump. So perhaps it fell short of a proper negotiation, but undoubtedly Trump was calling Putin as a way of reaching the Iranians as well. So when the United States tells Israel that it is not contacting or communicating with the Iranians behind Israel's back, it is not telling the truth. Having said that, I think in a sense this assurance, this American assurance to the Israelis is true. I don't get the sense that the United States has any coherent plan for negotiations. I don't think it has any coherent plan for how to succeed or wage this war. I read yet another article today in the Daily Telegraph in Britain, a newspaper, by the way, which has fervently supported over many years an attack by the Western powers on Iran in order to achieve regime change there, and which has been solidly certain that in the event that such an attack took place, the government in Iran would quickly collapse and that the Iranian people would rise up and greet with rejoicing their American and Western and Israeli liberators, just saying. Anyway, the Daily Telegraph dispatched one of its journalists to the Kurdish regions in Iraq. It found a complete lack of enthusiasm amongst the Kurds for some kind of conflict against the Iranians. It found a mood of fatalism and resignation and suspicion. And the journalist said that she could see no signs of any mobilization, of any kind of military preparations by the Kurds taking place. So that plan doesn't seem to be workable. The US Navy is resisting pressure, wisely resisting pressure, against steps to reopen the Straits of Hormuz. I've already discussed at length why I think the Kharg Island plan is wrong. And, well, frankly, I think that the plan to try to seize Iran's stockpile of uranium is so high risk that it has all of the potential ingredients for disaster. I fully accept that the United States has probably, in fact, I get to correct that, has certainly the best special forces in the world. But I think this must be an operation which is either beyond them or at the very extreme end of even their capabilities. And if the plan is to drop the entire 82nd Airborne Division into the centre of Iran to try to secure the area around Isfahan, well, this looks to me like a potentially even more disastrous operation. I mean, it sets up a situation like the siege of Dien Bien Phu in the 1950s. The Dien Bien Phu took place at a time when the French were fighting in Indochina against the Vietnamese. There was again a similar plan, or a plan to drop a parachute force, a paratroop force, far behind the Vietnamese lines, and all sorts of elaborate and clever plans were constructed as to how that would achieve victory over the Vietnamese. And what very quickly happened was that that force was surrounded, and there was a terrible siege which lasted many months. And in the end, the French paratroopers had to surrender. And well, the rest, as they say, is history. I'm not predicting such an outcome. I don't know what further cards the United States might have up its sleeve. It may be that if a situation like that arises, the United States would take even more radical steps, which would prevent a Dien Bien Phu type situation. As I've said many times, I am not a military expert. But the risks of this sort of operation bring Dien Bien Phu fully to mind. And I am sure that there are all sorts of people in the Pentagon, in the military there. The Pentagon, after all, has a Department of Military History, as I know, who must be alive to these risks and who must be warning the administration of them, and who are probably, or so I suspect, pushing back against this extremely dangerous plan. So what to do? Now, there is the option. The United States says that it's achieved all its objectives. Khamenei Sr. is dead. Much of the Iranian military leadership is dead. Iran has been very badly damaged. It's expended a lot of its missiles, though those probably can be replaced. It's expended an awful lot of its drones. It suffered heavy economic damage. Proclaim victory and move on and start something else. My colleague, Alex Cristoforo, said, only semi-facetiously, declare victory in Iran, give up on Iran, and refocus instead on Greenland. And I would say semi-facetiously, because of course the United States might conceivably would do that. But that would be a defeat. We see what these Israeli officials, Israeli intelligence and security officials are saying to The Guardian. If you just do something like that, then Iran might make the decision that it has no real choice but to move forward to develop a nuclear weapons capability, which is what it has refused to do up to now. And of course, it would still have its uranium stockpile available, and it would still be ready to do that. So again, that would be a problematic outcome to the war. It would pass the geopolitical initiative to Iran. You could argue that in military terms, Iran already has the initiative. It is choosing where to strike. It has got the Straits of Hormuz closed. It controls access through the Straits of Hormuz. So anyway, that kind of solution perhaps is not a solution at all. And well, it may be that for that reason, pushing for that kind of solution is going to create a crisis within the United States, between the United States, or at least the administration, and the Israeli leadership. It might be a very, very difficult thing politically for even this president to do. So that then brings us to the question of what does the United States do? Conventional military escalation perhaps is becoming more difficult. As I said, there are all of these plans, and supposedly a third carrier is arriving, though I wonder whether the reason the George H.W. Bush is being sent to the region is not in order to join the Ford and the Lincoln, but to replace the Ford. I understand that the Ford has been longer at sea than any US Navy carrier for a very, very long time. Ships, especially very complex ships, suffer wear and tear. The crew by now must be getting increasingly jaded and tired. It may be that even the Pentagon, or perhaps specifically the Pentagon, is now calculating that it can't be kept on station indefinitely, and that it must be replaced by a new carrier with a properly repaired and maintained, and with a fresh crew. But anyway, for the moment, the conventional military escalation option seems to me to be fraught with all sorts of risks and may have reached the point of diminishing returns. Of course, there is the further option of using non-conventional escalation, but I think that would be an extraordinary disaster. Sooner or later, if oil prices continue to rise, I think the United States is going to have to tell Israel that it needs to start to negotiate with Iran. It would be a negotiation conducted in a completely different way than the negotiations we have seen up to now. It would be like the negotiation that took place in Paris. I've discussed this many times, when over time the North Vietnamese found themselves, relative to the Americans, in an ever stronger position. The pressure would be on the United States to make concessions. The Iranians would probably begin the negotiations from the starting point that I've just set out. I don't want to anticipate what the outcome of those negotiations would be, but I can't help but think that given the situation that we are looking at today, they would plausibly leave at the end Iran in a dominant position in the Persian Gulf and in the Middle East, just as the Paris negotiations ultimately led to Vietnamese reunification and Vietnamese domination of what was previously French Indochina. Anyway, there we are. We shall see how all of this goes. Of course, we're still only 2 weeks in. This may have many months to go. The stresses and the strains undoubtedly are increasing. And anyway, we will see where this takes us. Let's quickly now talk about the situation in the other conflict, the other big conflict, which is the conflict in Ukraine. Now, there are reports, there are rumours circulating that within the next few hours, perhaps tomorrow, the Russian Defense Ministry is going to announce the capture of the important, actually it's a small town, of Grishino, northwest of Pokrovsk. And there are also further reports that the town of Belitska, north of Rodinska and close to Dobropolye, is also about to fall to the Russians, that the Russians are about to capture both of these places. And that is important in some respects because, of course, it brings the Russians closer to the capture of the critically important town of Dobropolye. And also with further Russian advances east of Konstantinovka, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, it tightens the siege of these three towns. Konstantinovka, from what I can see, is already mostly surrounded and I am going to guess mostly captured. That's my guess. I think the maps are probably very wrong about the true situation in Konstantinovka, just saying. But certainly in the case of Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, I suspect that they're going to be encircled also fairly soon, and that that will be a priority of Russia's spring-summer offensive. To repeat again, and I've said this in the past, Russian military commentators continue to say that the encirclement of Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, is going to create the biggest single cauldron by far in the war so far. It's going to trap the largest number of Ukrainian troops that we've seen trapped anywhere in the war. It will be the battle that finally breaks Ukraine. And by the way, that would not surprise me. Now, there's also been lots of reports and footage now which appear to show Russian troops in the northern Zaporozhye area where the Ukrainians have been claiming to have been conducting an offensive. Anyway, this has led some of the mapping projects to claim that the Russians are conducting a successful counterattack against the Ukrainian counteroffensive in this area. I don't believe that such a counteroffensive in any meaningful sense has ever taken place. I consider the best mapper with the clearest understanding of the situation in this area to be Scott of Calibrated, and he has discussed the real situation in what I believe to be the real situation in northern Zaporozhye very clearly and well. And I believe that these Russian soldiers that we are now seeing in places like the village of Verbove and wherever have always been there. They've not recaptured this ground. The truth is that they have never lost it. It was the same in Kupiansk. It's been the same in Doretsk. It's the same in Udachnye, in Kotlino, in all sorts of other places where we've heard about Ukrainian counterattacks. Mostly, not always, mostly these counterattacks either happen entirely in the realm of media, or if they happen at all, the gains that they achieve at exorbitant cost turn out to be purely ephemeral. Anyway, to repeat, we are now, as far as I know, in the spring thaw, in the Rasputitsa. The major battles are still to come in the spring and summer. What I would like to finish this programme on, however, is a very interesting article that appeared on the Substack site, Events in Ukraine. Now, I don't have any direct knowledge, personal knowledge, of the person who writes this Substack site, though I have found it consistently insightful. Anyway, in his latest article, this person discusses the state of Europe's arms industry and the supposed rearmament that is taking place in Europe. And he makes essentially the same points that I made in many programs, that the European defense industries, if you can call them by that name, are extraordinarily fragmented. Many of the companies involved, in terms of their actual production facilities, are relatively small. That a huge amount of money is now sloshing around within the system, which is probably greater than the European defense industries can absorb, and much of that is probably being soaked up by what you might call corruption, and that the actual genuine output of weapons is minimal. And to the extent that new weapons are being produced or money is being spent on new weapons, this is on super expensive, big ticket items like new fighter jets or new tanks, which can only be produced in very limited numbers. And which will only start to appear in several years' time. The reason the defense industries in Europe focus on these super expensive items is precisely because, of course, it is producing items like that, not cheap FPV drones in industrial quantities, or large numbers of shells, or that sort of thing. It is producing those kind of items that makes the profits. And I think this is exactly correct. And events in Ukraine also say something else, which I've always suspected is true, that a lot of European defence spending. He doesn't say this, but I'm guessing a lot of European defence spending in Germany specifically is going on purchasing weapons from the United States, which, however, go directly to Ukraine, where they disappear into the black hole which the war in Ukraine has become. And well, American production of weapons has its own set of problems. I read another article about Tomahawk missile production. It seems that the United States, over the last few years, has only been producing around 90 Tomahawk missiles a year. 90. And nobody knows exactly how many it has launched against Iran over the last 2 weeks. But the likelihood is we're talking about, well, numbers that should be counted in the hundreds. And events in this same article said that yes, there are plans to increase production of Tomahawk missiles to 1,000 a year, but reaching that point is going to take a long time. There have to be negotiations with to sort out the supply chains, there have to be the production facilities established. At the present time, to produce an individual Tomahawk missile, it takes roughly 2 years. 2 years. So Given that this is so, and given the demands that the Middle East war is making, the United States is having to reduce supplies of weapons to Europe. In fact, stop supplies of weapons to Europe. That is creating a crisis for European rearmament, which in its initial phases was very much based on the idea of buying weapons from the United States. And of course, it leaves Ukraine critically short of weapons as well. I think that Ukraine is entering the spring of 2026 in far and away the worst position it has been at any point in the war up to now. Most of the best soldiers, those who fought in the Ukrainian army in 2022, are either dead, wounded, exhausted, or have deserted. Apparently, most of the Ukrainian brigades now rely on recently mobilized manpower, and there are issues of motivation and training. There is a general shortage of infantry. There are more reports about the Russians having dominance in drone warfare. The Ukrainians, it seems to me, are in a very difficult position. Now, as for the Russians, the big story with them is great anger over the Ukrainian missile strike using storm shadows. The great anger over that attack on Bryansk. And the Russians are saying that the Ukrainian aircraft that launched these storm shadows took off from the region of Odessa, and they are blaming the British for the strike. They say that it was the British military which was responsible for the strike, and that the British have blood on their hands, and that they will one day pay a price for it. Well, I get to say my own thing here. I think that if it was a storm shadow strike from Odessa, I'm going to make a guess. I think these are more likely scout missiles, which are very similar to storm shadows supplied by France. And I think it's more likely that they were launched using French Mirage jets, the Mirage 2000s, which we know France has supplied to Ukraine and which have been almost invisible in the battle so far. Apparently, they are designed to launch scalp missiles, and it would be completely consistent with Macron's personality to have conducted a strike of this kind. Why the Russians, however, in that case would blame the British is another matter. The Russians have been angry with the British for a very, very long time in terms of this war. And I think that eventually they do feel that they have a score to settle against the British, and they will no doubt at some point find a way to do it. Maybe they're not talking about France because they still hope to patch things up with France once Macron has departed the scene. Even if it was the French, the Americans, as I discussed in my program yesterday, at some level must also have been involved. Anyway, I've been reading again the statements by the two spokespeople in Russia, Peskov, who speaks for Putin, Zakharova, who speaks at the foreign ministry. It's clear that they are uncomfortable by much of the criticism that is being levelled at the Kremlin for continuing to engage with the Americans at all. And incidentally, there has also been a strike of some kind against a gas compressor facility, apparently in the Arctic. The Russians are very angry about that too. I'm not sure what part of Russia's energy complex that pertains to. I will discuss that strike in my next program. The Ukrainians, incidentally, continue to keep the Druzhba pipeline to Slovakia and Hungary closed. The Ukrainians, according to Orban, have made threats against his family, which seems extraordinary. I find that astonishing. Of course, we have only Orban's word for it, but I've not seen any strong denials from Ukraine up to now. Anyway, we have all of that going on. But Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, says that despite this massive disruption in energy markets that the IEA is talking about, despite the critical potential situation in Europe, there must be no relaxation of the sanctions against Russia. For her, that is more important than anything else. She will sacrifice, presumably, European industry, the condition of European consumers, to that overriding objective, though one would have thought that by now even she could see that there can no longer be any possibility of victory, whether achieved militarily or diplomatically or through instruments of economic coercion in Ukraine. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar by going to our shop, links under this video. Please also check out our Substack site. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel if you've liked this program. Thank you again. More from me soon. Have a very good day.